This is an ABC podcast.
I started making, programming, creating and designing computer games back in primary school. Like, it's something I've just always done as a hobby and always wanted to do.
I have been a gamer, I would say, my entire life. But it really started with my mum and myself. My mum was very ill. She couldn't really sort of get out of bed. So we played this game, which was one of the very, very early forms of games, a Nintendo game called Parachute on the Game & Watch. It's a little score chaser. You just had to rescue little people falling out of an aeroplane and catch them on these little rafts. And I still can't beat her high score. She was really good at it. I wasn't so good at it. But we used to swap the little console, and that was how we kind of passed our day in these very sad days, really.
Hello, this is The Money on RN Summer. I'm Richard Adie. And today, yes, we're talking about computer games. It's a big industry, and if you don't play them, perhaps much bigger than you realise. Ron Curry is the chief executive at the Peak Body, the Interactive Games and Entertainment Association.
In Australia, depending which way you want to look at the industry, so if you look at retail value, it's about just over $3 billion in Australia. And that's across hardware, software and digital products. The other side of the business is development, which sadly is a lot smaller. It's worth about $128 million. So, you know, there's a big difference between what we're creating and selling on a global market and what we are consuming here locally.
And is the industry growing in either retail or in the developing?
The industry globally is certainly growing every year. Year on year, Australia is growing, you know, by 3, 4, 5%, depending how we measure it. And certainly the global business is growing as well. And, you know, it's expected to reach about $110 billion this year.
That is a massive number, isn't
it? Yeah, it's much bigger than the music industry. It's bigger than the film industry.
What does the market look like in Australia?
The industry is made up of console games, so, you know, PlayStation, Xbox, Nintendo, and a lot of those games you go and buy in a store. You know, JB Hi-Fi, EB, you know, some of your mass merchants. Then you've got digital games, so same sort of games that you can download through your PlayStation or your Xbox or your PC, which is a very large part of the market, that digital download. And then you've got a mobile business as well, so mobile phones and tablets.
Right. And how does it break up in terms of value? Do you know?
Yeah, so the value breaks up around 50-50. So at the moment, Australians spend about 50% of their cash on games in stores and the other 50% online, so buying digital purchases. Now, that's spread across mobile, or it's spread across, you know, the other digital devices.
I think mobile's the biggest chunk of it at the moment.
It's actually about $1 billion a year we're spending on mobile for games.
It's staggering,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, and digital downloads is about $900 million, so it's not too different.
Those sorts of numbers in a country our size mean a big percentage of us are playing. Megan Brownlow's the National Industry Leader for Telecoms, Media and Technology at PwC.
It's really interesting to look at the users of games, because we know now that if we include casual gaming, so the sort of Candy Crushes and the Plants vs. Zombies that you play on your phone, then you've got nearly two-thirds of Australians use some sort of gaming as a stress reliever. And then you add in esports, which is even watching others gaming via video, which is fascinating as well. So what's driving it is what has driven us to love sports in Australia. The same motivations. We watch sport on television, we watch esports online. But one interesting thing is young consumers, what we're calling Generation Z, who come after Gen Ys. They are the big drivers of gaming.
Despite those drivers, we're not big developers of games. Janet Gaiters, the creator and executive producer of former ABC TV program Good Game.
We got very damaged by the global financial crisis when it became pretty, well, it just became too expensive to develop large AAA titles in Australia. We did have quite a strong industry up to that, and then that pretty much wiped Australian development off the planet. But Australians are extremely well educated, extremely creative, and they are very passionate about games. And so what we saw happen was that then simultaneously mobile platform came online, and we have had massive, massive success on the mobile platforms, particularly games like Fruit Ninja, Crossy Road. etc. There's more. Really, really globally successful games. And, you know, some governments, particularly down in Victoria, have been very supportive. And there's a very, very lively and burgeoning game development scene in Melbourne.
That sounds great. So how satisfied is industry leader Ron Curry with the current situation?
Probably not overly satisfied where it is in Australia. Look, we've got some fantastic talent in Australia, but sadly a lot of our really good talent leaves the country for a number of reasons. There's some really great opportunities outside of Australia. If we look at Canada, if we look across countries like Finland and Norway, America, the UK, are really supported industries by the government. And, you know, I speak to my counterpart, for example, from Canada, who just laments the fact that he can't get enough talent to fill his studios. Then we look in Australia, we have about 980 developers in Australia. And at the same time, we've got somewhere around 4,000 students studying some game-related subject in universities. So where do they go? You know, there's just not the jobs for them. Yet we have other countries who are screaming for talent.
Warfighter's rare. Extremely rare. My parents used to talk about it like it was the most precious thing in the universe. That is one of the only memories I have of them.
On The Money today, we're looking at the computer games industry, and what you're hearing now is Morphite, a game developed by Blowfish Studios in North Sydney. Benjamin Lee's the managing director. He and his co-founder started in 2010.
We actually made a mobile iOS game, and that actually got featured by Apple and went to like top 10 puzzle game around the world. And that just basically gave us the confidence to start up full-time Blowfish Studios. So then, you know, first thing 2011, we started up in my two-bedroom unit in the lounge room, as you do. And we released two more games that year. And the second one was featured by Apple for the, I think it was the iPhone 4 launch. And that went to number one iPad game and top 10 iPhone game in the US. And that, you know, that brought in, I think, grossed over $500,000 US. So that was really good. And then from there, people like businesses, other clients got to see that. And so we were approached by Scholastic in America. And we actually started doing then work for hire, doing game development, you know, exporting game development services at the end of 2011. And just since then, we've just grown to now we're about 24 people full-time here in North Sydney.
At that size, Blowfish has to have a few irons in the fire when it comes to revenue.
We've kind of pivoted two consoles from, you know, the last few years away from mobile because mobile got very competitive and free to play. So now we've been focusing on console and PC and even virtual reality games as well. And we're working on a couple of new games for ourselves, which we are unannounced at the moment. But, you know, that one will be coming out end of this year and another one in another couple of years as well. But then also working on a couple of client projects, one for Scholastic, which is a really big two-year project, and that's coming out start of next year. My background is programming and software engineering, so we actually do standard app development as well. So we've actually gotten into that just because we've made a reputation for ourselves, both through our, you know, our titles being, you know, featured in the marketplaces, but also through the New South Wales Export Awards, you know, winning that the last 2 years. And so now people just come to us asking for, you know, for kind of standard software development as well. And so we're actually doing that because, you know, it's just an extra revenue stream to keep the business going.
What's the biggest challenge?
The difficulties are in that the industry is completely digital. You know, that means it's open globally to everybody. The tools that we use, you can get them for free. So it really comes down to, you know, your skills using those tools and then, you know, and, you know, creating art and things like that. So I guess the biggest challenge is a very globally competitive environment. And because we are digital, you know, we're competing with people in India, competing with China, in Europe. So, you know, on a cost basis, we can't compete that way. So we need to compete with the quality of our work and our games.
Blowfish is a success. What are its opportunities?
It's taken time to get here. We're in our eighth year now. So the opportunities, though, are quite good and quite big for us. Like I said, we started getting into publishing other developers' games over the last couple of years. And now we're looking to do that more because you know, the other parts of our business are providing, you know, good cash flow. So now we're actually able to invest in other smaller game developers and, you know, give them a chance to take their games to the world like we have with ours. So that's, you know, that's one side is really great. And then also, you know, our team, two of the members here have been with us since essentially 2011. So they've been with us 7 years now, and they started off as graduates. So our team as a whole is also building, you know, getting better, getting more experience, getting, you know, more games out. And in turn, that means our own products, our own games we're making, they're getting better, and we see they have more potential. So, you know, I think the potential there for our own games and publishing games is just huge.
Use the left stick to move around. Use the right stick to aim.
Blowfish Studios is part of an Australian industry worth around $120 million a year. But how big could it be? Ron Curry from the IGEA.
Let's look at Canada. So it's kind of a relative sort of country. They have around 22,000 game developers. So that's against our 1,000.
That's 22 times as big, yes.
22,000 big. They generate over $3 billion to the local GDP in Canada.
Okay.
And a whole lot of other stuff that comes with having studios sitting in your country.
So 22 times as many people, about 30 times as much in terms of money.
That's staggering.
And this is a population that's more or less the same size. Yeah. Lots of we're actually very similar to Canada in lots of ways.
Culturally, the same population. You know, they're, you know, around 30 million. So it's not a huge difference in what our countries look like and what our political scene looks like. It's just that their governments collectively saw the opportunity that video games presented and jumped onto it quite early.
What games are coming out of Canada? What would people know?
Assassin's Creed, for example, which is a great game by Ubisoft. They have a lot of mainstream games and a lot of independent games. So the interesting thing about Canada is they have a full ecosystem. So they have small independent studios, when you compare them to small indie music, you know, scene, right up to full-blown studios with 2,000-3,000 people studios. People like Electronic Arts and Ubisoft have one or two studios in the country. And it's a full ecosystem. So no matter where you want to enter that flow, you can come in as a junior, you can come in as a mid-level, you can come in quite a senior executive. And not just a game designer. You know, they offer a lot of opportunities right across the spectrum. You know, that could be accounting or lawyers, policy people, artists, musicians, analytics people. You know, there's a whole lot of opportunities across the business.
Okay, Ron, what would you like to see change here?
So if we go back a couple of years, the government had a Senate review into game development. And it was a really interesting process, and it was great to see at least the senators who were on the panel, how engaged they were with the industry once they got to know what it was all about. And they came out with 7 recommendations. So what they did, they looked at the whole, again, the whole ecosystem. How do we broaden the ecosystem and support large studios? So if you want to get a 1,000 people studio into Australia, then you need certain concessions from the Commonwealth government around producer offset allowances, maybe some other tax incentives at one end. Down the other end, you're looking at games funding. You're looking at supporting clusters, like we were talking about, like the arcade in different states. You're looking about how do we move that into regional centres? Why can't Warrnambool be the home of video games? Or why can't Newcastle or places like that? You know, Noosa has some great game developers there because they've got great infrastructure, they've got great broadband there.
What recommendations did the Senate review make?
So there's the government reintroducing the Interactive Games Fund. So that supports maybe the smaller independent game developers. There's producer offset allowances. So then we're talking larger organisations that get supported there. The government supporting creative workshops or cooperative workspaces. Innovation hubs in regional centres. So keep the talent where in the towns. Don't move these smart enterprising kids out of towns and into cities. Let them stay where they are. Far greater engagement with serious games or games for purpose. So what we've seen is the skills that you learn making video games, that engagement that comes with that, how do you transfer those skills into a purpose, into a reason why people would perhaps help with mental health outcomes or educational outcomes?
Or training within
training.
Firms.
You know, and training's like, I guess, and I don't say that in a pejorative sense, the bottom of the pack. Now, training is easy. It's all the other things that go above that. You know, we've seen some great work about using video games to help test kids' hearing because it doesn't scare them. It's more engaging. There's some better ways at testing. We saw yesterday some really exciting stuff that Cochlear is doing around people with cochlear implants and helping them to enjoy music again by using an app that teaches them how to recognise music again. So some really exciting stuff that's there that comes from traditional game development.
Part of what the games industry wants is a producer offset, like the film industry has.
What the industry is saying is, well, if we're using that for film, why can't we use it for games? Well, the added understanding is that quite often films come here, they get made, the stars and the production teams, off they go, back to the US or wherever they come from. You know, if you look at an Australian development studio who takes advantage or could take advantage of those schemes, they stay here. They're bricks and mortar. You know, they're here. They're employing people who stay here. They're, you know, paying payroll taxes, stay here, GST, sales tax, the whole stuff stays in Australia permanently.
Right.
And what we're creating is, in Australia, we know that game developers export over 80% of what they create. It's what we call a weightless export. We don't dig it up. We don't have to ship it. You know, and it's pretty much everything we develop is an exportable market.
And in fact, if we got bigger, that percentage would probably rise because we're not that big a market, really.
No, like 2% of the global market here. So it doesn't take a lot, if you can imagine moving that $119 million, even if we get half of what Canada's got. And even if you moved up to a couple of $1 billion, it's a huge difference in employment and infrastructure and everything that brings with it.
But it doesn't look encouraging. Of the 7 recommendations from the Senate review, the government's only been positive about one.
And that was a serious game one. And what they said is that they support it.
Mm.
It didn't say they will do anything to support it. They just support the notion that that's what should happen. So we haven't moved ahead from there. But look, saying that, we're still talking to the government. We're still having what we hope is some great engagement with them. You know, we took the Department of Communications and Arts quite frequently. We've exposed them to the Canadian experience over the last few months, and hopefully that'll give them some food for thought.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie. Today, we're looking at computer games, and I have to say, I'm not someone who really plays. Janet Gaiter does, though, a lot. So what's the appeal?
It's about agency. It's about the fact that you have control. You have control over your character. So whether that is in Age of Empires, I'm building an empire and then I'm going to launch my army against yours and then we're going to fight each other, or it's a game like World of Warcraft where I've crafted my character and I've put hours into developing her and she's an extension of myself and I've made friends in this game and I'm going to run around with my friends and we're going to do things together and sometimes I'll do things separately and there's a whole economy in there. I controlled her. She was a part of me. I felt like she was a real extension of me. And the friends that I met through World of Warcraft are my friends in real life, and they were extensions of them. That was really eye-opening experience for me as well, really, that through video games, I developed real-life friendships.
And that underlines something else. Games are social.
There has always been a social element to games. I mean, games, even before they were online and connected, they were about playing with each other in the lounge room. And so, you know, being competitive with your family, with your friends, in your console, even at the arcade, you know, the old Pac-Man, even though that was a sort of, you know, single player experience, your friends would gather around you, they'd have a go. So there was always that social side of it. When the internet came along, that really, really, really exploded. That meant that gamers could now connect up to each other and play against each other 24/7.
That sounds like a lot of opportunity to spend money. How much do you spend, do you think?
I like to compare it to golf. Right. My parents were golfers and I look at golf and I'd say, right, you know, they had their golf membership fees of a couple of $1,000s a year and they bought themselves a new set of clubs every year. And then there was the social side of it. Gaming is cheaper than golf, Richard.
Right.
Yeah. Even with a top end PC, which gamers like to have, you know, you want to be able to have equipment that keeps you at a competitive level and you have to have a really good internet connection. And then you might have the fees for the game or whatever, but, you know, it's still cheaper than golf.
Cheaper than golf.
We're starting the tournament with the addition of the play-in stage. You have to play your style and you can't let the other team really dictate it. You just can't drop a single game.
Esports isn't golf. It's computer games for spectators, elite level players, and big money.
It's massive. It's massive, and it's been massive for ages. It's like, oh, hello, rest of the world. Finally, you're waking up to it. Esports is, I guess, the cream on the top of all the rest of us as gaming. So you know how people are really passionate about professional football, Premier League football. It's just like that. You know, people, millions and millions of people play football, and then there's this cream of the crop stuff. Now, when I watch a professional esport player play a game, I am in awe of them, just as if I'm watching, you know, Messi score a brilliant goal. It's that kind of level of appreciation that we have for these esport players.
This is the thing I find hard to get my head around. This is a spectator sport.
Oh, absolutely. And what is kind of almost more alluring about it is the fact that I can play that game. I can play that game tonight for hours on end, and I can play it at my level, and I can have a really good time, and I might even get a little bit better the more I play it. And then you see these players play it, and you're like, oh my word, something like League of Legends. You know, the way they play that game, you think, if I had every minute of the rest of my life, I couldn't play at that level.
Megan Brownlow from PwC says the sector offers lots of opportunities.
Esports has multiple revenue streams. So they're live ticketed events, and we're seeing the grand finals being played into our cinemas. So you can go to Hoyts to watch the grand final of League of Legends. The Etihad Stadium and all of the big sports stadiums are becoming set up for the big grand finals and even the competitions for esports. So you get that ticket clip initially, but then also there's an advertising revenue stream, because a lot of the video online where your children and my children, everybody's children, are watching others play, they're being interrupted by ads. And this is an audience that's hard to get to because they're not consuming some traditional media. So you get to them that way. And then you've got what's called microtransactions, which are very, very clever. It's a business model pioneered by the interactive gaming industry. And what that says is, if you're following a particular celebrity gamer and you want to send them a cheer, you can. And that just gets charged to your mobile phone bill.
There were several huge esports tournaments in Australia last year in some of our biggest stadiums.
Absolutely. And they're purpose-building arenas for it now. And that is because, you know, unlike popular media would like to present gamers as isolated people playing in their basement, that's not the truth. We do like to get together. We do like to celebrate our culture. And that's what those big esport arena-like events allow us to do. We can come together, we can cheer our teams. We follow the elite sports people just like you would in any other kind of form. I know who my favourite player is. I'm going to make sure that I'm there to support them. And it's also extremely engaging the way they present it, you know, like it's big, flashy, it's, you know, amazing screens. The atmosphere is amazing, really.
How big is the esports part of the whole games industry? Megan Brownlow.
It's a small part currently, but it's growing. So the owner of League of Legends, the publisher, Riot Games, they're actually a Gen Z business. They haven't been going for very long. They're about 14 years old. They made $3 billion out of subscriptions to their games in 2016. And then at the end of 2016, they were purchased by a big Chinese company called Tencent. So Tencent's one to watch. They make good investments. They also invested in Tesla batteries. So this is a smart, smart business. And Riot was one of the businesses that they locked onto to invest in.
Elite athletes are some of the best paid people in the world. What about esports? Can you make a living?
Oh, absolutely. Prize money for esports competitions is getting up to $20 million now. So, you know, you could funnel one of your Gen Zs into being a professional tennis player, or you could funnel them into being a professional esports player. However, I have to tell you that your career is pretty much over from the age of 25 as a player because you lose your agility. On the positive side, it's not gender-based like other types of sports are. So a young woman can be as mentally agile and as physically agile to play esports as a young man. However, like traditional sports, once your agility is gone and that part of your playing career is over, you become a commentator.
Yes, you do. You become the expert commentator.
Cloud9 improved to 3-3, and they are now SKT's biggest fans.
I can't be surprised!
Australian game players don't need convincing. This is an industry that's growing fast and not remotely close to reaching maturity. So where does Ben Lee think Blowfish Studios will be 5 years from now?
I wouldn't want to be like much bigger. I think, you know, get up to 30-something people. Having more broad revenue streams coming in, having one big hit, another big hit of our own game, and then also becoming a globally known publisher of other people's games as well. Yeah, and then able to essentially just decide and fully fund, you know, a large game of our own that we can just have a team of people sitting on that full time. So, I mean, so at the moment we can't do that. We can't have somebody, you know, a whole team full time on one of our own games. It has to be back and forth between, you know, work for hire, publishing and our own games.
Ron Curry has a bigger perspective. He has to think about the whole Australian industry. And he's positive.
I am optimistic. We do have some great conversations with government. It's interesting, you know, at the Senate inquiry, you know, everyone sort of leant on the desk and, you know, chins on fingers and said, so what are you going to do if you don't get funding? And we said, well, we'll just keep doing what we always do. We just keep making games. We'll keep doing it. We'll make great games. What we won't do is make as many great games and contribute as much as we can to the local economy.
You don't happen to know whether any people in Cabinet are playing games, do you?
Lots of them are. They say they don't, and then so we asked the question, you know, it's probably one of the first questions you asked, well, so anyone playing Candy Crush, anyone playing Words with Friends, you know, and those sort of games, it's like, oh, well, yeah, but they're not games. It's interesting they don't see that traditional moving from a paper-based game onto their phone as playing a game, and then we remind them that it is a game. You know, and it's interesting, a couple of senators saying they bring their Xboxes into Parliament House to update them because the internet's quicker than it is at their parliamentary offices. So, but I'm not going into who those are.
Janet Gator has an interesting point of view. She's both a lifelong gamer and an ABC TV executive producer. She thinks about content for a living.
I think one is going to get very strong, and I think that's the gaming side of things. I think gaming is still really in its very early stages. As much as it is massive and it's global and we're being well connected, there's so many challenges still in the gaming space, particularly with, you know, storytelling and capturing that sort of deeply immersive feeling that you get when you play as a character in a game, and the agency that I was talking about earlier, being able to control that character. There's still some challenges there, and I think that they are going to conquer those, and then it's pretty much over for sit back and watch stuff.
So movies and music.
I mean, I think there's always going to be a role for beautifully made movies and music, but I think the days of people just sort of sitting down and turning on a box in the corner and just consuming what's being given to them, there's some thought needs to be given for how exciting that is going to be for, particularly, you know, when you think of younger people who've grown up with video games and they're never going to stop playing video games, you know, they already don't necessarily watch television. What on earth is going to bring them back? Why would they? There's no need to come back because games can give you more.
Thanks to Janet Gator, who created and EP'd the ABC TV program Good Game. Also Ron Curry, the Chief Executive of the Interactive Games and Entertainment Association. Megan Brownlow, National Industry Leader for Telecommunications, Media and Technology at PwC. And Benjamin Lee, who runs Blowfish Studios. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Andrei Shabanov. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.